everybody, and welcome back to Disc Coverers, the only podcast online that reads, reviews, and ranks all 41 of Terry Pratchett's seminal series of comic fantasy novels, The Disc World. I, as ever, am your host, Iris J. Pronouns are she or zare, if you're feeling spicy. And I have a special, well, not guest host, but always special host, Grace, in the booth with me.
Live from scenic Iris's apartment, I am the internet's beloved princess, Grace. She, her, or fae, fear, fair, if you're spicy, and it's a pleasure to be here, as always.
Woo! Also, we have other special guest host, Chester, our cat. You may hear him periodically throughout the course of the broadcast.
And if you don't, we'll just add some more in post.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure I can get some more recordings of him meowing.
This space to fill with just random recordings of cat meows to make it sound like the cat attacked us.
It makes it sound like morning DJ nonsense.
We'll go pick up Rosie and hold her up to the mic.
Aww.
I'm Juniper. She, her. I also have a cat. Her name is Rosie. She's wonderful. Yeah.
Maybe.
I'm Belina, she slash they. I do not have a cat these days, I'm afraid. There's a snake downstairs, but that's probably not a good idea, and doesn't make very good podcast noises. We have enough trouble with sibilances as it is.
What's the snake's name?
Poco.
Oh, it's a good snake.
It's adorable.
It's a good snake.
He's fucking great. He's not mine, but he's here.
I've always wanted a snake, honestly.
Snakes are cute. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan. I mean, the rug in my office is a giant snake print, and also I'm a secretary bird, so I'm always hunting them snakes, but to kiss them on their little noggins. Anyways, we're here to talk about The Truth, by which I mean the book The Truth, put out in 2000, part of Terry's Bangers era, and a really interesting and kind of not necessarily self-contained, but definitely like not part of a series book about the, not invention, but like popularization of the printing press in Ankh-Morpork.
The decriminalization.
The decriminalization of the printing press and subsequently the rise of Ankh-Morpork's first newspaper, the Ankh-Morpork Times. This was a wild ride of a book.
Mm-hmm.
I have not read this book in a very long time. I remembered enjoying it. I forgot that I fucking loved this book. I love this book. I love this book so much! I'm so excited to talk about how much I like this book. It was weirder than I remembered, but also, oh, I love it.
It's much weirder. It feels like it almost, like,
this really is the first real Discworld.
No.
Bingo card.
But, yeah. But this really is like a, it really feels like, oh, this is like modern Discworld. It is interesting because I think this is the first time where like, we find out, it was just a little minor detail, but we find out that like, not only is the whole century of the anchovy thing, like does that line up with our centuries, but also the numbering schema for years is the same in the Discworld as it is in our world.
Except they don't usually refer to years by number.
They don't.
Except for like for the established in joke.
Right. It was just like, wait, so what happened in Discworld 2,000 years ago that made them start dating things like that? That's so
odd.
But
they still say it's the century of the fruit bat and the year of the anchovy or whatever.
They still have goofy names for everything. I guess it's kind of like how you have like the Showa era in Japan, but also like numbers.
I mean, remember, this is Britain. We can't have normal names for anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, measured out my years in grams and liters.
Yeah.
They literally do anything other than use the goddamn metric system.
Yeah. Oh, it's the year of 23 stone.
Mm. 30 hogheads until Christmas.
I will also say I did read this book all in one night because I got very, very into it and was a little bit out of it for some of it. So there's parts of this book that y'all are going to mention and I'm just going to be like, what? Oh, yeah, that I don't remember that at all. So we'll see how that goes. But I really enjoyed it. I love these characters.
A lot happens in this. It's not like...
It's very tightly wound.
Yeah, like, it's not, like, the longest book by any stretch, I don't think. But, like, it's there's a lot that happens. It's tight.
Actually, on that note, do we want to do our synopsis quick?
Yeah, Synoptrix Bellina.
I'm going to do my best, but, man, like you said, this one was wound real tight, and I had a lot of trouble with it. So, all right. Give me one sec, and... Movable type has come to Ankh-Morpork. While it's been a thing for years already, the city has had a soft ban on it for the general reasons why a despot might not want the public to be too well informed. However, as a group of dwarves stumble into town and nearly run over hapless William DeWord and news that a writer of modest means, it becomes clear that it's time to let the technology run its course. The Ankh-Morpork Times is founded and begins quickly turning stories into papers into money. Enough money to get the attention of the Gildium Graders, it goes so far as to amend their charter to include printing and set up a competing tabloid newspaper in an attempt to form the Times out of business. Of course, while this is happening, there is a conspiracy to do a character assassination on Lord Vetinari. The new firm, a couple of pulpy villains from out of town named Mr. Pin and Mr. Tulip, who attempt to use a Vetinari lookalike to frame the petition for murder and embezzlement. The plan, of course, goes sideways, but enough of it succeeds that the Times gets itself into severe trouble just trying to report even the most basic facts of the case. An attempt to chase the story runs afoul when, in an attempt to find Vetinari's pet dog Waffles, they attract Pin and Tulip to the Times itself. In the ensuing fracas, the camera from Say Cheese and Die is deployed, thank you, Otto, and it unnerves Mr. Pin enough that he starts making sloppy mistakes. Attempting to tie up loose ends and flee the city, Pin and Tulip come back to the Times itself, and after another altercation, accidentally alight the architecture. This leads to Tulip floating in lead, and Pin pinned to a desk. Looting the firm's bodies gives William and crew enough the money and resources to publish their story, clear Vetinari, and buy off the guild. As everything settles back to normal, William and company unfortunately realize that being journalists is their normal now. The new firm moves on to their own next reincarnations, and those in power get off more or less scot-free, save for the knowledge that their anonymity is no longer quite as impenetrable as it once was. We must move with the times, after all.
Woo! Woo!
Wow, well done.
Very dense book. Shit. Excellent work covering all of that.
This book was really tightly wound, and I was impressed by... So this is jumping ahead to the very end of the book, like, probably not what we want to do at the beginning of the podcast, so I'm going to do it anyways. The thing that impressed me most about it is how one of Pratchett's problems is that the mystery usually gets solved very early on. Like, he doesn't really do mysteries where there's still, like, a mystery by the end of the book. Usually you can find out what happened pretty fast if you're paying attention. And a lot of it is more figuring out, well, how are they going to get out of this one at a certain point? Which, while cool, does, like, detract from a bit. What this book did that was really interesting to me, though, was it replaces the mystery most of the way through. Because you go through it and you figure out, oh, well, here's how Vetinari got framed, here's what they're doing, here's who's running the Times. It keeps bringing up little things for you to focus on. But then at the end of the book, when it all gets revealed, it instead goes, no, the real twist is it was his dad the whole time. And that's an entirely separate plot that was not that important to the book, but has a lot of emotional stakes at this point. And now there's an entirely different thread for it to draw, like, pull on while it goes into the finale. And I loved that. I thought that was really smart. It made me care about the ending of the book a lot more than I've cared about other Pratchett endings.
While it does seem to come out of nowhere, there's plenty of little things that were hinting at it. Like the nonsense. I mean, William gets to the bottom of this because, oh, right, shit, this is the thing that my dad says all the time. And there is a point where the anonymous, circle of jerks is talking back and forth, and William's dad does chime in with a, have I ever told you that a lie can run around the world before the truth has got its boots on? And everyone just goes, yes, you've said that a million goddamn times. And it's played off like just as a little one-off joke, but that's actually a load-bearing joke.
Yeah, there's a lot of little details like that. There's a ton of stuff that keeps coming back in the book and getting referenced over and over, and I really, it had a lot of good brick jokes, but also it did have that, and it meant that the ending, like, instead of the ending being, well, we have to wrap up all the bad guys and bring everything back to what it was, like a lot of Discworld books have, which is fine, that's good, it works. Here it was like, oh, there's a whole other thing going on here, the main character's relationship to his dad. I actually do kind of care about this. It depends on how much you care about the main character, but, like, it brings in a completely different thread to care about that I really enjoyed.
And it also makes it a book not just kind of about class disparity, but extremely about class disparity.
Yeah. This book had some themes.
Yeah, it's the rare Discworld book that doesn't have anything to do with kings, but it sure has a lot to do with the aristocracy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to talk about, you know, just the fact that, you know, the kind of realizing three quarters of the way through of William going, ah, fuck, I really am my father's son, followed by, wait a second, hold on, I can use this.
Mm-hmm. That, and everyone else like, yeah, you are kind of a rich asshole, but it's okay. You're trying.
Yeah,
it's interesting the way that they frame that, the way that his character is framed, because like he doesn't really get better by the end of the book. At the end of the book is full of people being like, yeah, you are so egotistical and constantly correcting everyone else around you and doing it in this really specific way. But also it's like, but you know what you're doing. Your heart's in the right place. You aren't being a completely rich asshole, and you're genuinely fighting for something that matters. And you're trying to be a good person. And actually that stuff does matter quite a lot.
Putting that Harvard-educated trust fund kid energy to good use.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
thinking about, like, he's like, I didn't say thank you, did I? And Otto's like, no, you didn't, but you noticed that you didn't, so, you know, you're working on it.
God, Otto. I can't start talking about Otto. I won't stop.
Oh, he's so good. Again, I had to cut off, like, 90% of the cast out just to make that summary work, but everyone at the time was so good.
Yeah, we are two books away from Carpe Jugulum, and I think it's really fun.
Yeah, no, it is kind of amazing how... No, sorry. When you said two books away, I thought you were implying it was in the future, not in the past.
No, we're out from it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Previously, here, this is a metaphor for... Like, in Carpe Jugulum, vampires are a metaphor for the aristocracy. They're immortal, they're parasites, they're fucking awful. In Fifth Elephant, there's still a metaphor for the aristocracy, but there are some who are trying to move with the times and trying to become more modern and find more subtle ways to manipulate the population that aren't just sucking blood and striking fear into the hearts of mortals. In this book, vampires are just people. Mm-hmm. They're just homies.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're just guys.
They're just guys.
They're guys who are working through some shit and trying to get over their addiction. Yeah. Which, you know, who isn't?
Mm-hmm.
God. Otto's such a great character, too. I honestly wonder, having read the last two books, how much of his characterization is intentional. Like, not to not give Pratchett Cat credit, but Otto is such a perfect line between, like, a comedic joke and the sad clown actively playing up the comedic joke because...
You have to laugh or you cry.
You have to, yeah. And, like, a later book actually comments on this. I need to pull up a quote. There's a quote from a, and I'm going to pull up a quote from a future book, so sorry for spoilers.
my virgin ears.
Yeah, so Otto shows up again in Thud, and I'm trying to find the actual quote exactly. Vimes is talking to him, and he goes, it's strange that they don't seem to mind you, Otto. And Otto goes, well, I'm not official. I do not have their sword and their badge. I do not threaten. I am just a working stiff. And I make them laugh. Vimes stared at the man. He'd never thought about that before. But yes, little fussy Otto in his red-lined black opera coat with cloak with pockets for all his gear. His shiny black shoes, his carefully cut widow's peak, and not least, his ridiculous accent that grew thicker or thinner depending on whom he was talking to, did not look like a threat. He looked funny, a joke, a music hall vampire. It had never precisely occurred to Vimes that possibly the joke was on other people. Make them laugh and they're not afraid. It's an interesting characterization of Otto, and the book actually hits it really well. I don't know how much of it is intentional, because I've seen him do similar things and just kind of, they didn't work in recent books, but here it just works so well. Otto is so charming and fun and also kind of very sad and wonderful, and I love everything he does, and I love him, and he's wonderful.
I mean, he's so running parallel to William. I mean, he's someone who is trying to not be a horrible piece of shit, but he's definitely has a much better control of himself.
Yeah.
The way that he swings around, and the fact that the act he puts on with, you know, the senior Mr. DeWard, of making it look like he's going to throw out everything, you know, throw away the black ribbon and just utterly kill William's father, only to stop because William tells him to stop. When I don't think anyone, and I don't think the reader actually believes he's likely to go through with it, but that's not what's important here. He's demonstrating that he can flip it on and off when it matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he cares.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, in the scene, he says the reason he gives for not doing it is because William thinks he's a good person. Which is just such a good line.
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
like, God, I love this book. I love all these characters. I love how much they're trying. And I mean, characters who are trying to be better people despite everything means a lot to me. Mm-hmm. And this book has a bunch of them. William's a really interesting character in it, the way that he is very much kind of like, the way he goes from seeing himself as not responsible for his rich upbringing because he was rejected by his family, to like acknowledging that he does have privilege, he has a responsibility because of that, and also he has a duty to not be part of that, that these are things he has to consider. He can't just throw them out and say, well, my dad was a rich person, but he was an abusive asshole, so I've never talked to him, and I have no relationship with rich aristocracy, to like, no, I was raised as rich aristocracy, even if it was hell. That is something I have to consider when thinking about myself.
You still have this last thing. You still have the education. You still, like... I tell this story a lot, but one time I saw the Bush sisters, like George W.'s daughters, speak at an event, and they were like, oh, well, we're starting a charity, and we're doing it all with sisterhood, and we're doing it all ourselves, and like... just said, no, you didn't. You can't. Your last name is Bush. Your dad was the fucking president. Like, you know, you can't act like you did anything yourself. It's like fucking Steven Spielberg's daughter directing all by yourself. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, you can't just be anti-classist by just staying out of everyone's way and pretending it didn't happen.
Ma'am, you have stories about your Secret Service agent telling you to make up with your dad who you got in a fight with, who, by the way, was the president of the United States.
Yeah. By the end of the book, he's, like, actively considering this. He's considering, he thinks about what he can do with the money and such, but also, like, the fact that, like, yes, his upbringing has made him act in certain ways. There are things he cares about. And also, like, how shitty his father is. And he has both an acceptance of who he is and also a complete and total rejection of his dad. Which is exactly what you want. You want something where it's like, I understand that, yeah, this is something that, whether I like it or not, it's a part of me. And I don't like it. And I want it to not be a part of me. So I'm going to work on that. That's great. That's good shit. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
It's so thoughtful.
This arc is, like, mirrored in so many ways in this narrative. I think that I really unexpectedly really came to love the character of Saccharissa, who starts as, like, very, central casting, like, stock upper-class girl slumming it here at the news station. I mean, but eventually...
she's described as such.
Yeah, but she eventually gets a really keen eye for, like, how to sell papers, and it's kind of implied that she's kind of the brains behind how they actually make money.
Yeah, she's the one who knows how to do headlines.
Yeah, she can do headlines, she knows that names sell papers, she's the one who comes up with the idea of having special interest magazines so that they can sell news that isn't news, but is, like... events and interest articles to people who might be interested in them.
People play for pictures of cats.
Yeah. And
yes, hi, Chester.
It's such a, like, her relationship with William feels believable to me because it's not one built on, like, romance, secret pining, or whatever. It's just like, these people have been through hell, they're working with each other every day, and they've kind of become, like... They just dovetail really nicely. Their brains mesh. Mm-hmm.
These two people are so fucking autistic about the news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you
want, they really are. If you want, all three of the main cast are.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. If you want to sell a romance to me, don't show me them just making goo goo eyes at one another. Show me them, the two of them working together. I believe in these two much, or these three, I guess. We'll get to that later. much more than I do for any previous couple, because you see them working back and forth. You see them actually filling in for one another. They actually, they've got chemistry. It's great to see them both in the same scene.
Yeah, they work better. I mean, they're fighting for like half the book, but the conversations they have are like, it's one of the times when like, oh yeah, these two characters are fighting like an old married couple or such, actually works for me, because they kind of are. They are constantly arguing in a specific way where it's obvious they care about each other and their opinions a lot. Just, they also think the other is a fucking idiot. And they're right. Both of them are very wrong about certain things, and they're able to compensate for each other's flaws in a good way.
Mm-hmm. To be fair, they are kind of figuring out this whole newspaper thing on the fly.
Yeah,
so.
No one's done it before, you know?
Yeah.
Which, incidentally, there's a lot of fantastic jokes from the whole figuring out the newspaper thing on the fly. I loved the gag of a troll walking in, asking for a job, about, like, I want a job. I've worked as a bouncer before, and that's it. And William being like, well, we don't really have a position. Another guy comes in with an axe. I'd like to make a complaint. Well, you'll have to take it up with our complaints department right here.
<That's very laughs>
just
good.
Been hired.
Yeah. By the end of the book, he's like the sports desk, which is great.
Yeah. It's okay, he can't write, but no one who cares about the sports desk can read. It works out.
Oh. This is funny, given that eventually we will get a sports book.
Yes.
Awesome. God, I wonder if he shows up in that.
Oh my god, I can't wait to find out.
The fact that his name is Rocky, he's a boxer.
Oh my god, you're right.
Yep.
Jesus Christ.
Do you want to hear the funniest joke in this book that I genuinely don't know if Pratchett intended to be a joke?
Sure.
Go for it.
I actually realized this while reading fan fiction, and one pointed out, because I read a bunch of fan fiction after this book, because I love the characters that much. You know what every single vampire always likes to do in order to disguise their name? In Discworld?
Backwards?
Write it backwards.
Oh my god,
what happens when you write auto backwards?
Oh, shit!
I don't know if he meant that to be a joke, but it's really funny.
It's good.
That's great.
There were some good bits in this.
Yeah, there really were.
Also, you could tell this book was written in 2000 because it opens with jokes about the paperless office and e-commerce.
God, yeah. Venari is fully, like, on board for tech speak.
He's an absolute poster. Mm-hmm. There's even the damn Men in Black joke. Like, you know, 1,000 years ago, we all knew the world was round, but now we know it's flat and it sits on the back of a bunch of elephants on the turtle. Imagine what you'll know tomorrow.
it's really
fantastic.
What little of Venari we get in here is really interesting, because he's very much trying to be progressive Venari, and that's such a huge like shift from who he was when he was drunk and talking to Vimes about how the world really works in Guards.
Yeah, it's...
Like, he's much less of a cynic now, which is interesting.
Yeah, it was honestly really weird near the start of the book where he shows up at the Times office and he's, like, weirdly personable and, like, weirdly, like, he just wants to make sure, like, hey, there's not going to be anything, like, weird about the press, right? It's not going to, like, be like that Clacks business or that musical.
It is a really funny gag, though, admittedly.
Yeah, it's going to be... cult canny inscrutable, I trust.
Mm-hmm.
Him showing up and just being like, this isn't built on an ancient burial ground or something? There's no horrifying crack in reality beneath it?
You didn't just find all these parts, did you?
Or like, he's talking to someone and he's like, you'll make sure that they come to no harm. And they're like, do you mean come to no harm or come to no harm?
I'm not, did you just wink? Yes.
Yeah, like ensure they do. They should not do not hurt them.
I mean, at the same time, that actually was an important scene, because this is very much one of those that has. There's okay, this has been kind of the rule for the last few books, where the problem has been people going against people. It's not people against, it's not PvE stuff where there's some horrible thing beyond reality, like we got in a lot of the early books.
I'm glad he established that early, because that is what you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, yeah, that's
you want the grounded human problem.
Yeah, the best Discworld books are stuff that's PvP content. Protagonist versus protagonist.
And it works so well because it takes this like larger issue of, well, class relations, the upper class trying to basically go, we don't like that now our city is multicultural and diverse and better. We need it to be worse so that we can control it. And it takes that and takes it from a very like big overarching thing to a very personal thing at the end of the book. It hits on both levels, both as like a, the city needs this paper because it's a way of, it's a method of like basically giving people power, but also he needs this paper because it's an act of rebellion against his actively extremely classist and shitty father. Like it ties those two together in a way that works. It's a good book.
Yeah. Speaking of protagonist versus protagonist, I loved that Vimes was in this book, and I love that he is in an antagonistic role in this.
Yeah.
He is not the main character's friend in any shape or form.
This is one of my favorite gags in the book, is that you see Vimes and you have the whole conversation where Vimes is like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. They talk in his office, and William keeps being like, oh, well, I figured out this thing. And have you figured out this thing? And then after they leave, Vimes is talking to, I think, Angua, and just like, he's smart. He figured out all the stuff we had already figured out. He didn't figure out these things, though. It's just like, yeah, Vimes is still really fucking good at this, even though he's playing the antagonist role. It's great.
Or, like, the whole bit where, like, William knows there's a werewolf on the watch, but he assumes it's Nobby.
Yeah.
When he tells Vimes about this, Vimes is just... Yeah, and Vimes is just like, oh, you figured that out all on your own, did you?
Not a yes or a no, but like, wow, great detective work there.
Yeah, oh, you figured that out, huh? Or who told you that?
Angua remarking that your powers of observation will be talked about throughout the entire building for weeks. Just, oh, beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, Vimes was great in this. He obviously hates this, and like, it's not hard to see why. Of course Vimes would hate something like this. It's like everything he doesn't like. But also, like, he's not antagonist enough that he can't see, like, oh wait, hold on. This does matter to some extent, and I don't want to, like, actively destroy this immediately. This is something that I'm going to be in competition against, not, like, trying to kill.
Part of the friction of being in a modern city.
Yeah, we can look at this and know that Vimes is radically against this for perfectly good reasons from his perspective. The fact that a protagonist from a previous book has such a wildly different outlook than the protagonist of this one. That,
yeah.
Again, we're just, the dynamics are complicated enough that we can see why they're in conflict without either of them actually being wrong.
Mm-hmm. It's good.
Also, the books are getting more overt about, look, we know the cops fucking suck. Nobody likes them. But it's,
yeah.
He's doing better. He's never going to get where we want him to be, but he's doing a lot better, and that's better than not.
We'll have a conversation once Night Watch comes along, because that's a complicated one. But
pointing to the big old WrestleMania sign that is Night Watch, being like, someday we're going to get to that book, and it's going to be a motherfucker of an episode.
But, like, yeah, no, he definitely, there's definitely more of a complex relationship with the cops in this book. I also want to say that just from that perspective, I also liked that the newspaper wasn't portrayed as fully heroic either. Mm-hmm. Like,
no.
Obviously they're the main characters, they're the quote-unquote protagonist, well, they're the protagonists, but it really, like, makes it clear that, like, nah, they kind of suck, and they are kind of doing this for, like, sometimes personal or petty or otherwise reasons. They're much better than the other guys, but like they aren't great. William is an asshole for basically the entire book, and the book is never like he shouldn't be. It's just like, yeah, he sure fucking is, isn't he?
Yeah,
it's... And like it works a lot better because it makes it feel like, okay, these are all of the sorts of weird people who exist in a city. These are the sorts of weird things you have to deal with. Not like, oh, well, this is the good guy fighting against the horrifying bad guy that you can sometimes have. It just makes the times out to be another thing in the city. It fits Pratchett's whole, like, everyone in this place sucks perspective a lot better than previous books have done it, where it's like, oh, they're all terrible assholes. Here it's like, no, I believe that these guys all suck, because they suck in ways I understand.
Yeah, there's that whole thing, there's this whole thing throughout the book where William lives in this boarding house, and every day he goes and has breakfast, and one of the other guys in the boarding house reads the paper out loud, and like they're all talking, and it's like, well, you know, I wonder who decides what goes in the paper, and William just kind of sits there and doesn't say anything until the end, where he's like, no, I wrote that, I know what I'm talking about, and he's like, just you? I thought it was, you know, experts who, like, knew what was right. And you're like, no, it's just me and some other assholes. Like, we do our best, but, you know?
One of the weirdest breaks there is the fact that everyone is so immediately trusting of the newspaper. Because, like, where does the imagined authority come from?
It's even just, like, you know, William notices near the start of the book, like, well, once it's printed in black and white on a sheet, it looks so much more official, which, you know.
And maybe especially
pre-internet, you know.
Yeah, in a society where printed words are probably a little more weighty than they are now.
Especially in the Discworld, where, like, previously if you wanted something printed, you had to, like, get a guy to engrave it out of wood.
Right, and, like, one of William's previous jobs before the newspaper was being a scribe, as in helping illiterate people write letters and stuff.
Yeah, which, again, that... Even in the Discworld, being able to read and write is still, like, kind of a luxury. Like, we meet Piss Harry, who, like, can't read. It's never stopped him. But, like, having something written down and typeset nicely is, like, oh, wow, someone clearly put some effort into making this statement. It must have some higher truth value.
I love Harry King. Yeah. You want to talk about, like, a minor character who's like, this guy is for sure an asshole.
Yeah.
But he's also kind of base.
Yeah, like, he's a capital S small business owner.
Yeah.
Before we talk about Harry King, I wanted to mention one other quick thing, which was on the subject of like where the newspaper gets its authority in this world. Pratchett's done this a lot, honestly, with stuff, is just kind of assumed that something has authority because, well, in our world it does, is kind of a thing. Like, the whole, all of moving pictures.
Yes.
Why do movies have such power? Well... because they're magical, you know? And the real reason there is because they have power in our world, and, like, I'm writing a book that's a parody of movies. Right, but in this one it actually works well, because he's not like, oh, there's some mystical power behind it. He just kind of rolls with it. He's like, well, of course there would be a newspaper, and of course it's going to function like our newspaper. And because we're reading a fantasy story that has a bunch of stuff in it that is kind of parallel to modern times, honestly. We're like, yeah, of course that makes sense, and you roll with it. It works so much better than, like, moving pictures or Soul Music did. Not that those books are bad. I like Soul Music more than probably is fair, but, like, it works a lot better here because it's not portrayed as some weird magical thing, and also because he doesn't have to blow it up at the end.
Yeah, we can keep having a newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the other thing I want to say is there's the scene near the end where Vetinari shows up to inspect the press, and he, like, shows up with his cane and, like, taps the press saying, you know, curious, you call this a free press, yet it is bolted to the ground. And they're like,
you know, apartment complex seems quite, like, simple to me.
No, the paper is real. But you charge for it, no? It's so called free press, yet you charge for it. It's like, no, it's free as in we're. You know, that free isn't free speech. It's like, oh, so you are free to print what you want. That's what you mean by free press. And they're like, yes.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, curious, carry on.
He sounds so disappointed.
Not that he said that was okay. They just did it.
Yeah.
And then expected there would be no repercussions
later. Yeah, because there's a whole... This thing comes over several times in the book with, like, you know, oh, the ancient Ankh-Bor-Porkian right to free speech. It's like, we have that? Like, there's never been a law against it.
Yeah, I have to admit my favorite gag was the twin cases of Vetinari saying that it's the right of every citizen to walk the streets unmolested, and Drumknot goes, wait, seriously?
Yeah, there's no law against it.
Yeah, no. I also do want to give a bit of a shout out that it's an important point that movable type has been a thing elsewhere in the world for a long time. This was not about the invention of it, because, like, even though that, like, Good Mountain is a joke on Gutenberg, and, like, Gutenberg was not necessarily the first person to think about movable type. He's just the one who got famous doing it. This was about letting it happen, because it's one of those inventions that 100 people will come up with it when it's time, and it's clearly time for it.
Yeah, and it's also, it's existed for a while, and, you know, clearly in other places in the disc.
I did love also, that Good Mountain's partner is named Bodoni after the famous type designer.
Yeah, there's like two or three like font dwarves.
That's very great. Good.
And then a dozy, because we got it. We can never truly let go of our roots.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Also, on the subject of the thing I completely caused us to steer away from, yeah, I fucking love Harry King. He's fantastic. Mm-hmm. What a great character. Just a really weird guy.
Yeah.
His whole thing of being like, nah, I do trash pickup because I'm gonna get fucking rich off of it, and I treat it like a gangster, is fantastic. It's a great gimmick. His whole thing of like, I want to make my daughters very happy and make them feel like nobles because their dad is, while extremely rich, picks up shitty trash for a living. And
yeah, and he smells awful.
Yeah, smells awful is fantastic. It leads to the best moment with Vetinari, where they get Vetinari at the end with expecting some big statement, and then it's like,
yeah,
are you going to go to his daughter's wedding? And he's just like, oh,
I guess I am. And all the important people of the city will be there with their shining carriages dressed to the nines.
Otto figured out how to do color photographs for that.
Yeah.
It's going to be a great event. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's anyone will be there.
And then also the moment when the whole reason that I think Pratchett came up with this character of when William walks away and Harry King's just like, ah, of course, he's a muckraker.
Yes, it was so good. Like, you know, man's a born muckraker. You know, I used to rake muck.
Yeah.
Yep. It's a great gag. Great gag all around. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think the whole reason they like tried to introduce like 1947 sound year numbering is because he could give Piss Harry a sign and said, oh, yeah, we've been taking the piss since 1942 or whatever.
I love the gag that's like, he had to take that sign down because his wife thought it was in bad taste.
Yeah.
It tells you so much about him and his relationship with his wife.
We never meet. Like, we never see his wife.
We never see her, but we can already assume so much about how they get along.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very Columbo-esque relationship.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. There's so much
conveyed by, well, you know, the wife, this is how she likes
it. Yeah, well, you know, my wife. Well, you know,
my wife, she wants to seem like respectable, you know.
Oh, you know, Borat voice my wife.
Also, just like, he's great. He's one of all of the characters in this, honestly. I really liked what they did with them. They had great stuff.
Speaking of unexpected characters who you liked, we haven't really gotten into the actual antagonists of the book yet. Mr. Tulip and Mr. Pin yet.
Yeah.
There is a thing. All right, the L-Space annotations for this, I'm not sure. I know Grace and I read those. I don't know about June and Iris. But the annotations are actually surprisingly slim for this one, given everything. And there's a big section in there about how Pratchett was apparently very frustrated that people thought that Pin and Tulip were obviously based on like three different groups, including Vega and Jules of Pulp Fiction. Tiny parenthetical there. You think that he references Pulp Fiction so many times because of the word pulp?
Yeah, no, absolutely. This 100%.
Is Pulp Fiction, after all.
Exactly. Yeah. It's fiction about pulp. But he does like six different references to that one movie between these two. It's like, of course people are going to think that they're inspired by it because they're quoting it all the damn time.
Yeah. They're doing the, you know, oh, they don't call it a sausage in a bun in a clatch or whatever.
Yeah.
Having said that, I did actually like them a lot.
Oh, no, they were
great
characters. They were
pretty entertaining, yeah. Tulip was actually
a fucking fascinating character.
Yeah.
There were so many good gags with this character. The fact that he starts out constantly having his slurs, or curses, just endlessly being line ing, like they censored something out, and then later on it's revealed that he's just saying ing.
Yeah, but they can hear the dash.
They can hear the dash somehow. And everyone's like, that's obviously a slur, but I don't know how he does it.
It's funny, I've known people who grew up in very strict households who actually did that in real life.
Yes, that is absolutely what's going on, is he was taught not to swear, but he just continues to yell something about this ing door.
There's a certain kind of joke. Yeah, it's a joke that turns into, oh no, this is actually deep-seated backstory that tells you a lot about who he is.
Yeah, because, like, his whole thing is I understand the letter of the law, that's all I have to understand. I don't have to think about what it means or why it exists. So long as I'm following the rules, I'm good.
Yeah, so long as you've got your potato, everything will be fine. God. And you're really, really sorry.
It comes up, like, at the 11th hour, but, like, you get it, like, during his this was your life section, and you just get that one little aside of his grandmother saying that as long as you've got a potato, you'll be all right. And what she was actually saying was, like, you've got food, you'll survive another day.
Yeah.
He just, this became his entire philosophy, is just, God, the economy of storytelling for Mr. Tulip was incredible.
And also the entire fucking bit with him and Art. I want to steal that for, like, random criminal characters that I have. It's just like big angry shitty guy who sees a piece of art, immediately knows how valuable it is, has no interest in stealing it because he couldn't really do anything for it, but god damn it, why do they have that there? That's worth so much more than it should be.
The fences were just melted down. It'd be a shame to do anything with this fucking
Bumash. It's a real gift and a curse to be the kind of art thief who's so intelligent that you know exactly how much things are actually worth.
He also has there's also this weirdly prescient bit where the joke is that he loves to do drugs, but which means he'll do anything in a baggie, which means he's always doing, like, drywall, or he's, like, smoking big joints of drywall. And there's a couple weirdly prescient jokes where he's taking dog dewormer and bath salts, but, like, you know, presumably actual, like, things you would put in a bathtub.
Yeah. Huh.
My man out here, like, inventing fucked up.
He's so ahead of the game. He's taking those 2020 drugs.
We almost had fucking Terry Pratchett inventing lean, like, just a few years too early.
I think
that's such a dangerous timeline.
I think he should hit the dab. I think he should have gotten to do that.
God. Yeah, I love him. What'd y'all think of Pin?
Oh my god. What an oily little bastard.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yep. Like, I'll be clear. These characters are not... They're not Jules and Vega. They do these constant references and the like, but they are so much their own characters, and Pin is just so well distilled. The dude is just the oil, the grease off of every sleazeball you've ever known.
Yeah, he
poured into a single dude.
It's another shot at, like, it's like they did Mr. Tiatame, but, like, good.
I was literally gonna say, they feel like the natural evolution of Tiatame's gang from Hogfather, where it's like, oh, these guys are those guys, but, like, evolved and competent at their job.
Yeah, and you actually, like, kind of care about what happens to them.
Yeah.
Like,
I
mean, they're still stuck, but, like...
But they suck in an interesting way.
Yeah,
like, even like, Tulip looks at Tulip and goes, man, it really sucks what happened to this guy. He could have been something great, but, he just got everything good hammered out of him at a young age, and then the worst person in the world found him.
Made that
asshole a sympathetic, tragic character. What are you doing?
Yeah, just like as soon as Death was like, yo, are you really sorry? And he's like, fuck, I don't know. Can I think about it? Like, which is so good. It's like, yeah, shit, am I? Like, looking at all the people he's killed?
That's
he's
a
like,
good question, actually. Yeah, I gotta think about this for a little while.
Yeah. It's good.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Pin is immediately like, yeah, I'm so sorry. Here's my potato. Let's go. Yeah. I don't believe in anything, but I do believe in saving my own ass.
Yeah, there's such a good bit where, like, there's so many good bits in there where, like, A, Death is like, say hello to my little friend, and he pulls out the Death of Rats. And also he's like, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? Other than myself, of course.
Yeah.
I was wondering if anyone else did.
I love that gag. I think that gag is in like multiple books, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's used twice in this one, because earlier Pin uses it to refer to the Disorganizer. And even, hey, they actually made a good Disorganizer jokes.
Yeah,
because this is the Disorganizer merc too, after people kept destroying the first one because it sucked.
Mm-hmm.
It's one that's learned.
It's one that's actually...
I love William literally... At one point, William literally just says, like, okay, so, like, what happens when I hit this button on the side? And the imp inside is like, well, that's when it hits... That's when it bonks me on the head and I start recording. And William's like, can I just, like, tell you to start recording? And the imp is, like, offended at the very idea.
Yeah, it's in the manual. Like, yeah. You gotta do what's in the manual.
You can't just jailbreak this. Come on. There's protocols. That was good. Also, Gaspo the Wonder Dog makes a triumphant return in this book.
He gets four.
So we don't forget about talking to him like the last time he was in a book, and we forgot talking about him. Gaspo the Wonder Dog is also in this, mostly so that they can make a fucking Deep Throat joke.
Yep, there are so many Watergate jokes. They literally come in through the Watergate, which I didn't notice until I read the L-Space annotation.
God damn.
Yeah, he goes. Gaspo goes by Deep Bone. They meet in a multi-story parking lot.
A multi-story horse parking lot for horses.
Yeah,
they need to unelect the patrician.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like Pratchett has to have one thing per book that he can focus on and make terrible jokes out of.
Yeah.
To be fair, All the President's Men is an excellent movie,
and there's literally the whole even the plan to like. You know, replace it, and then, oh, he'll pardon Vetnar, so no one has to worry about it. That's, you know, what Gerald Ford famously did.
Yeah, I feel like Pratchett needs one of those things per book. One thing that he can just endlessly harp on and do a bunch of real-world references to as much as possible. So that, like, the rest of the book can be normal.
Yeah,
like...
Not that it's bad, it's a bunch of great gags, but, like, he has to get it out of the system somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, like... We got that, and we got all the Pulp Fiction jokes, of course. Like,
yeah.
You know, the not a very nice person at all wallet.
The fact that Mr. Pin just has a crisis of faith and suddenly needs to get out of the business is a fucking Pulp Fiction pull. I'm pretty sure they had the briefcase early on.
Full of money. Whatever.
Yeah, it was actually full of something. We actually saw what was in it, but for a very brief moment, it was the briefcase. Oh, right. Originally, the briefcase was just supposed to be full of diamonds. They put a light bulb in it sort of as a gag and just kept it.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of other stuff in the book.
There's this whole very good bit where every time Otto, this whole thing where Otto keeps taking pictures with Darklight that show the past or the future, what's really there, and like, that leads to some really good bits. It's what gives it's what gives Mr. Pin his like crisis of conscience.
Yeah, because he sees ghosts.
And there's a couple good bits there.
I will say I love that, and I also love the way that that Otto actually does color printing, which is that he just has four imps. And three of them have on heavy red, yellow, and blue goggles so that they can do four-color separation printing. And also that he invents how to do newspaper printing by having them paint with acid instead of paint so that they can do
etchings.
Yeah, which is so, that's so... Of course that's how he would invent it. How printing
works.
It's
weird fantasy logic because you have to use weird acid that doesn't behave like actual acid.
Yeah.
But
it does. That is like using the world at hand. That is how you would reverse engineer that,
which makes as much sense as the iconograph already did. It's like, well, I already got away with this one. Surely they'll let me get away with this. And he's right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. What matters is consistency, and it is consistent.
Yeah, it feels like it's leading up to this one joke where like he's holding it. He's like, you let go of those prints of darkness. And it also ties into the bit where every time Otto says something like, oh, it's in the mind's dark eye, and he expects there to be this crash of thunder. That was an Uber boss.
Right.
Yes.
That right there, that was my favorite joke in the book. No contest.
Threatening Lord de Word. And he's like, oh, it's a bird. Let's do it again.
Castle.
It's so funny. He does it like two or three more times.
Specifically, it's when they go to the other newspaper office and...
There we go.
What's the dwarf's name again?
Good Mountain?
Yeah, Good Mountain is like everyone goes home with a headache, gets $100 right now.
Yeah.
And someone's like, what happens if we don't? And Otto goes, well, then you get... A headache. And immediately there's thunder outside, and Otto's like, yes,
it's so exciting.
Let me try this.
Like two more times to like, yeah, it worked.
It ends with him yelling music with rocks in. It's so fucking great.
Rock and roll.
That's so hype.
It's so good.
It's
we get a little cameo from Dibbler in this book too, but he's not like a main player. He's just writing all the junk articles for the Inquirer.
He's doing what he's good at, and just the fact that they equate horrible tabloid journalism with making his horrible sausages is pitch perfect.
Literally, how the sausage is made, and also when Bettinari shows up at the start, he's like, "And Mr. Dibbler wouldn't be involved in this enterprise, would he?"
He's like, no, sir. I just got that. God damn it!
We remember the movies.
They do eventually poach him away, but it's selling ad space. He does not get to write for the paper.
I do love that they rescue him, and they're like, "Yeah, you're. We can't deny that you're very, very good at this. Do you want to just lie to people to sell things instead?"
Like, well, you know, it's like, can we have you sell ads? He's like, oh, selling nothing. I can do that.
Yeah.
You can sell blank space any day of the week.
Yeah, it's when you need me to sell real things that everything goes Wahoody shaped.
Yeah.
Footnote, I did have, because I had to look it up. Wahoony is another weird Discworld thing that's, I don't remember when it ever gets defined, but it's
basically a durian. They call Ankh-Morpork the Big Wahoony,
It's a durian.
I thought it was...
Which is...
I thought it was...
It's described as being a big spiky fruit, like a large durian. Yeah, with the side joke of a lot of people think it smells like shit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I guess, like, what did y'all think of the actual plot itself? Like, the whole mystery with Vetinari and... that part of the book, them trying to keep the paper afloat, the structure of the plot, so to speak.
I thought it was really interesting in that, like, from a small press angle, it is really fun that, like, they did it, like, they hit the problem that you kind of hit in real life with small press stuff, speaking from somebody who's published things before, where it's like, there's kind of a weird line, where it's like, if you're printing something that people are excited to have, there's like, you start making it and people are like, wow, I can't believe this didn't exist anymore. This is so great. And you can sell it for real cheap because there's the novelty of it and you're filling a niche in the market. But then you hit that point and it's time to expand. And when it's time to expand, you both need to expand your offices and your facilities in order to produce more of the thing that's popular. And also you need to expand your readership base, because selling your stuff at such a cheap, cheap price, suddenly you need to have a much bigger economy of scale in order to make that work.
There's a discontinuity.
Right. It's what turns the press into a hungry animal. And it's like, the real dangerous part comes when people stop taking the newspaper as a novelty and start taking it for granted, because then you need to keep up with it, not just put it in front of people's faces. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really interesting as like a look into the business of producing a regular periodical.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't really answer a lot of the questions it brings up, but like, I don't think it has to.
I don't think
it just kind of goes, hey, this is a weird thing, huh? This is kind of fucked, and then moves on.
Because there's really no answer to it in real life. It's like, wow, wouldn't it just be easier if we lied all the time and like didn't publish anything? And the answer is yes, and that's why the internet killed newspapers. Mm-hmm. But you still have to make newspapers because it's the right thing to do, and also because, like that Saturday morning breakfast cereal cartoon, you have the exact mental damage that makes you want to do this.
Yeah, because you have newspaper brain, you have journalist brain, and what else are you going to do if you're not making a newspaper?
Yeah, you need to tell the truth to people.
Yeah.
I'm proud of this. Pratchett has finally moved on from great men of history theory, where you think you just need one really good guy and that'll solve all the problems, to the still the problematic but at the very least, a funnier autistic man of history, where you just need one person who's really into one specific thing,
okay,
and he'll solve that problem forever.
Yeah, you need a man who's traumatized so that he won't let himself lie. I could relate to that.
Okay, no, I want to say that it's moving more towards you don't need one great man. You need a 100 kind of shitty people willing to pull in the same direction.
Definitely. I would definitely agree with that. Like, I was making a joke. It's something that Pratchett, like, I have a lot of, I could rant about this. I could rant about a lot of things for a while, but it's like, it's a weird thing in this book because Vimes actually confronts William at one point and is like, who keeps you, like, doing the right thing?
Yeah.
Who do you answer to? And he's just like, the truth. And Vimes is like, okay, what's that? Is that a person? Yeah. Is that a... There's a stat... There's a goddess, apparently. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, it's like, how nice for you.
I mean...
How nice to you that you don't answer to anyone.
I mean, the fact that nobody really does it is, again, part of the current woes of society, let's say. Because, like, everyone assumes that if you go out of line, society itself will come down on you like a ton of bricks, but it turns out that they kind of just don't. And again, yeah, that's not these aren't things that this book could ever have answered, even if it had wanted to. But it generally has to boil down to if I say something, if I lie about somebody, they're going to take me to task for it, and that's really the best you can hope for.
Yeah, like you have to have standards. You have to do things because it's what's right. And
yeah, because Joker voice, we live in a society.
Yeah, we live in a society, and it would be wrong to lie to people because you want their money.
Yeah. You can do it, and you probably could get away with it, but it would suck.
it would be bad. It would be bad, but there's nothing stopping you from doing it.
You'd make the world a little worse.
Yeah, the only thing that really stopped the Inquirer was the fact that the Times just got this giant windfall and managed to buy everything out. That's the only reason that they kept going. It's like, if Penn and Teal hadn't been in the picture, if this case hadn't happened, the Times would have been shoved out of business eventually, and we would have just had the Inquirer.
I was gonna specifically be like, well, yeah, that's one of my biggest faults with the book.
Well,
is that, like, it doesn't have an answer for how do you deal with something like this. Not that it needs to have one, but that kind of just, like, it solves it by going, fuck it, big money. But at the same time, like, now thinking about it, I actually do kind of like that the weird fascists can't help but orchestrate their own demise.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
That is how it works in real life. It's not as direct, usually, but, like, the weird guys who are fascists are going to go, well, I can't live with the fact that poor people exist in my city, so I'm going to do something stupid, and it will destroy them in the end. Like, usually it involves a lot more of normal people suffering, but, like... Yeah, that is a thing. That's how it works. I don't know. I like that, actually.
You could argue the truth did set them free. They would not have gotten that windfall if they weren't doggedly pursuing the truth and doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't think it's perfect, but I actually do kind of like that.
It's tidy in a narrative sense. It's tidy in an ideological
sense.
Yeah,
it's what you do if you have a 200-some page novel that you have to exactly. Pitch inside.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
I just want to shout out, because I have the book open to it, but favorite joke of the book, probably the one that I've been thinking about the most since I first read this back in high school, was page 78 in your paperback copies. Readers, words resemble fish in that some specialized ones can survive only in a kind of reef where their curious shapes and usages are protected from the hurly-burly of the open sea. Rumpus and fracas are found only in certain newspapers, in much the same way that beverages are only found in certain menus. They are never used in normal conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since I read that when I was a high schooler, I was like, hey, yeah, that is true. You do sound like a prick if you just use the word fracas in regular conversation.
And then William does it anyways because he is that kind of prick.
Well, that's because I did it anyways because I was that kind of prick.
Absolutely.
So I get you.
William is so relatable.
Yeah,
just
I hate being so relatable, but I can't argue with you.
What's the point of knowing words if you can't use them in conversation?
William is so relatable. He's He has a specific brain. He has the specific brain that's like, I have to do things in this specific way, otherwise I'm going to go insane. But yeah. he manages to make it work by being really specific about things. And at the end of the book, he gets into a weird polyamorous triad.
Yeah, love wins.
That's all very normal.
You get a callback to that gag later, too, where Will is trying to think up a headline for the story, and he tried to think up the headline. He couldn't quite get a grip on it yet. There was too much to say, and he wasn't good at getting the huge complexities of the world into fewer than half a dozen words. Sakarissa was better at it because she treated words as lumps of letters that could be hammered together any old how. Her best one had been on some tedious inter-guild squabble, and in a single column read, "Probe into Shock Guild Rumpus." She's like, she's this close to inventing the variety headline.
Yeah, yeah. She, like, one more year, she'd do Nick's Hicks, Sticks, Clicks, or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, there's so many good bits. There's we get Igor from...
Igor!
We get... There's a lot of good bits where, like, I love when William is... He's talking to someone, he just, like, writes down everything they say, and there's, like, are you doing journalism to me? And he writes that down, there's, like, you know, yeah, you can't write that down. Well, can I write down that I'm not allowed to write that down? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's good. It's, you know, yeah, you know, all these things imply other things and how you, it's very good. It's fun to read about how the way you can imply things if you don't let yourself strictly lie, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, the bit at the end where they've figured everything out and they're just publishing a story and claiming that the Watch figured it out on the logic that the Watch will figure it out within a couple seconds of them reading the paper and saying, I'm gonna be on Vaughn's bad side anyways, I better be on his bad side for making him look too good.
Yeah. we have been working with the Watch. Oh, and also the bit where Vetinari is like, when you mean the Times, you mean you two. You mean William DeWord and Sakarissa or whatever. Like,
well, yeah, we got Otto in the basement, and then there's the printers, but you know,
Yeah. As it's like, and I'm sure you two, I mean, sorry, the Times will be present.
He's to be so sassy in this book. It's so good.
It's so good.
He's the best when he's allowed to be a catty little bitch.
Why do you think I give him the rarity voice?
Your brain is huge.
Damn. From a very just like personal perspective, I really liked the scene where William goes and tries to confront his dad. Mostly because it doesn't really work.
Yeah.
He decides he has to go do it alone and it fucking sucks and it can't really work because his dad's not going to listen to him. Because that is exactly how it works when you go and try and like talk to a shitty, conservative, rich, abusive family member. That it doesn't work. They're not going to listen to you. It doesn't matter what you do. Yeah.
He only responded to, well, violence. And nobody's proud of that. But the fact that when things finally get through to them and he just leaves and going, man, you really are my son after all. And that hurts William more than anything else.
Yeah. Because William always throws it in his face like, oh, you'd never actually hurt me. You have people for that.
Yeah.
You know, you would never need to get your hands dirty.
She got a little real with that part. Yeah.
And then, of course, Otto has to beat up his dad. But you know what? If you're vampire... If you have a vampire boyfriend who's willing to beat up your dad, you should let him.
Yeah, I think that's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the thing is, like, it comes across less as you have people for that and more like, Otto's not doing this because I told him to. Otto's doing this because he cares about me.
Yeah.
And I'm stupid and decided to run off and try and confront you on my own.
Yeah, friendship is magic.
Yeah. I love Otto. Can we talk about how I think Otto and William and Sakarissa should kiss?
Yeah, it's after the hour mark, and I was about to say, should we move into the ranking? So I think we definitely need to give it some time here. We should talk about how they should probably kiss.
Yeah, I think all three of them. I want to say, I posted this on Mastodon and such, but there are 18 fan fictions of William and Sakarissa. There are 41 fan fictions on AO3 of all three of them together, and this is correct.
Love wins.
That's great.
I'm so glad that AO3 makes that so easy to find out.
Yeah, who's winning?
It's very fun.
In which direction is love winning?
It's really like the NASDAQ of shipping. It's, yeah. It's a really appreciated service that they provide.
You know, the efficient ship markets hypothesis.
But also, like, in general, I do really like the chemistry the three of them have. Like, you don't get a ton of Otto and Sakurissa, because aside from the one scene where Otto's like, you're too sexy, you have to go, I'm a vampire, I can't be around you, you're too sexy.
I have a sense of response to the heaving bosoms, and you're breathing too heavily.
Very stupid, but a little bit funny. But, like, William and Sakurissa actually work really well together. The fucking scene where William is like, a lot of men have been interested in Sakurissa. I need to go and pointedly tell her that she's not my type. I need to make sure I go and do that.
And then
such a weird, shitty move, and it works.
Otto's trying to offer him tips on how to work with ladies.
Mm-hmm. And then the whole thing at the end with Otto being like, nah, William thinks I'm a good person, so I'm not going to kill you. That's good.
Yeah, that's good. That's gay. That's good. Mm-hmm. It's great.
I think, yeah,
it's gay.
I think they should all make out. It's gay. I think it's great.
You said it a really phenomenal piece of pornography from AO3 into the group chat. Yeah. That was real great.
It's not the first time AO3 has been posted in the group chat, but it's the first time I believe that we've had explicit pornography posted in the group chat.
I can't Congrats decide whether I want to link it in the show notes. maybe. I've advertised not safe for work projects in the show notes before.
Content warrants. I mean, AO3 is one of the most responsible NSFW.
Maybe just That's post true. The name of it, and then if people want to go look it up, they can.
What tag to search for, perhaps.
If you're under 18, don't read it.
Yeah. If you're under 18, get the fuck out of our podcast. Yeah. We can get in trouble.
Yeah, why are you
Sex
listening
penis.
To this?
No, you can let me know. Like, we're not that bad, I don't think. If you're under 18, don't talk about this. You shouldn't be telling people what you do online like this. If you go read it, lie. Don't tell anyone.
Yes, thank you. If you're under 18, at least have the good sense to lie. We have to say, if you're under 18, get the fuck out of here, because otherwise we can get in trouble. But we can't stop
for this
you
podcast.
From lying.
I think we can tell people don't look at the porn if you're under 18, but I think our podcast is fine.
Debatable.
Yeah. What's the worst thing we've done?
We made people think about interesting times for over an hour. That's pretty bad.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, it's not that we did anything bad. It's just that we did things that are cringe.
I have a few jokes I have to shout out.
Yeah, fire away.
One of them is, again, another weirdly prescient joke that our darling Belina prepared me for, where as an Ace Attorney nerd, there's a joke in there about how they once called a parrot for a witness in a murder trial where he, you know, accidentally predicts one of the best Ace Attorney moments of all time. Well, yeah, without ever, either because he played this obscure Japanese Game Boy Advance game, or, you know, came up with it from first principles, which I'm willing to believe.
He was a gamer, though.
Yeah?
He was a gamer, but there's no damn way he was importing untranslated visual novels from Japan.
No,
there's
the game,
no way.
The original Japanese version had an English mode, but it was, like, for Japanese people learning English. It wasn't the localized version we would know.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, probably for a lot of VNs, I imagine they do that.
Wild.
But yeah, I would love to see the differences in that version. I imagine it's a lot more, you know, they obviously don't make it Japan or Fornia. There was one bit that, like, I had to put a star next to, two, like, pretty close to each other, I think, where, William is being held up by Mr.'s Pin and Tulip, and he is dictating a message to the dwarves to, like, he's communicating with the dwarves via them typesetting, via them putting the font in the rack, and, you know, William is pretending to be terrified, quote, it was a pretty good impression of an abject coward, he thought, because it was casting for type.
God damn it.
And later,
hey-o.
And sooner or later, like, stuff rushes together, and it's a clash of symbols with an S.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
My favorite joke was just everything Otto does. I love
the, like the whole
so
bit
much.
Where, Yeah, where he has the thing full of flashbulb lizards, and because he's a vampire, every time he takes a picture, he collapses into dust.
Yeah.
But he keeps a little thing of blood around his neck, so he poofs right back up.
That's William's idea.
Yeah.
That was like, for the first few times, he's just screaming in pain, and it's just
he's just
really good evocative screams too.
Yeah, he's just like willing to deal with this because he loves photography so much.
Yeah, but it's whatever he reconstitutes, he always gets a little piece of like whatever he's
the carpet or whatever.
Yeah, whatever he falls into.
Okay, I do have to say though, like I've known enough photography nerds to know that that really is just the way they are. They will do horribly. The chemicals you have to deal with to do photography will fuck you up real bad if you're not real careful, and you can only be real careful so much of the time.
Yeah, especially if you're doing it in like your basement or whatever.
Yeah.
Also, I thought it was funny that Otto is a bee totaler.
Yes.
For blood.
Yeah. That's not what the T in teetotaler means, but it doesn't matter because the joke works on its own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess my last question before we go to the ranking is, we've talked a lot about how much we liked this book. Was there stuff that y'all didn't like? Like, what did we not enjoy as much?
There was a weird bit about how Lord de Word is, like, weird about, quote, those black humans in Hawanda land.
Oh, yeah. Well, this actually does kind of put to bed once and for all that there are, in fact, racists on the Discord.
There are human racists.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, because there's a very... He kind of avers, like, well, my father has a different term for it. And
Yeah.
Wow. That paints a really stark picture, doesn't it?
On the other hand, the other part of that conversation of them talking about dwarven marriage customs, actually enjoyed that a lot. That was really cool.
That was interesting.
I adore William trying to put it to work later.
He tries to like, okay, Dad, like here's your fucking money. I don't owe you anything anymore. And he's, hey, that's not how it works, but it's a nice gesture.
Yeah.
I feel like the book was, I don't want to say like, bounced around a bit in the middle weirdly, but it kind of did. The driving force for pretty much the entire book was just how incredibly necessary William felt it was to make a newspaper, which while very cool is like maybe not it doesn't always work. Sometimes it can feel a bit meandering, like why is this happening? Well, because this kid desperately wants to.
I feel like this story, and like this is, you know, Plummer says, the universe really is like a bunch of pipes when you think about it. I feel like this story would have worked maybe a little better as a series of serial novellas.
Mm-hmm.
Or like as, if it adapted into a film thing, as a mini series more than a movie.
Yeah.
If you think about it like that, like, there were discrete acts, and they were structured well, but I think they worked better as that than as one solid thing.
Yeah, you could even have like each episode be like one issue of the Times. That would be fun.
Yeah.
Oh, this book would make such a good miniseries, though, wouldn't it?
It does, because looking back at my notes, it starts like, I forgot how it started with like the wizard, and we do get, the berserker gets a name, which I don't think he had before.
Yeah.
Like Dinwiddie or something. And we find out where the dried frog pills come from, which is weird, but like...
Yeah, from the fucking Apple store on Unseen University grounds.
Yeah, it's wild, like, I forgot that's where it started. Like, we start with William, then we go to the UU, and then we, you know, they're talking about movable type or whatever, and then we go to the press. It's wild.
Yeah, it's a bit all over the place in that way, but like, I don't mind it too much.
No, it's not like that.
It works out. Yeah.
I also think it's maybe like... It didn't make me cry like other Discworld books have. I loved these characters a lot. I really loved what it did with them. But like, that's not really a point against this book. More just like, wow, Carpe Jugulum and Reaper Man and those really are something, and Feet of Clay really are something special, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Really something really special there.
Yeah.
Also, it's canon they have... Don't even think this book makes it canon. They have sex shops in the Discworld.
Yeah,
like they make it a canon that Mr. Scrope, the guy who they're gonna install as Vetinari's replacement, runs a sex shop.
He runs a BDSM gear.
Yeah,
he runs Doghouse Leathers.
Yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, as part of the head of the guild of leather workers.
I get why they're probably setting him up as their guy, because he's used to being pushed around by figures of authority and just wants to make a buck without. Oh no, I just got that joke. No, he's he likes being pushed around.
Yeah.
He's
the fucking PM with the day collar.
Jesus Christ, I just got that joke.
Oh, Jesus.
Wow.
I will say also on that note, I really liked a lot of the running gags in this joke, in this book. Yeah. Like, all of them worked. I liked the stupid vegetable joke a lot.
Oh yeah, where they keep bringing these humorous vegetables to the times, and they get more and more tired of it after a while.
Yeah, and eventually even the narrator is starting to just make cracks about it.
Yeah, it's like it got kicked right in the humorous vegetables at some point.
Mm-hmm. Also, before we kick into the ranking, I also want to give a shout out at the start of the book. During the dedication page, they mentioned that Terry mentions that he got the idea for the streets underneath of Gleam Street from Pioneer Square in Seattle, which is where we are broadcasting from.
Yeah, it was like wild seeing that note at the end, like, holy shit. Like, I thought that seemed familiar because it's straight out of the fucking underground tour.
Because that's us. They literally talk about, so like back in the day in Seattle, they had flooding issues, and they built up the streets to fix it. But not all the businesses were fully built up. So they had streets that were higher than the sidewalks, and people used ladders to get up and down them. And yes,
people did fall.
People would fall. Horses would fall. It was a horrible system that no one liked.
Yeah, there were like bridges. Bridges made of, like, you know, sheets of wood just laid across the pit that you would have to cross.
Eventually, they just, after the fire in Seattle, they just built upwards and they just sort of bricked over. And you can still go on tours when you come to Seattle of a lot of the lower levels in the more historic parts of the city. And it's really fascinating. If you do visit here, I recommend it. It's really cool to see all this stuff sitting just beneath our feet. Yeah, I thought that as a Seattle person, I was like, whoa, Seattle mentioned, hell yeah.
Yeah, like even says like, hey, you know, this was inspired by the beautiful city of Seattle, Washington. If you're there, try the clam chowder, which is good.
You should try the clam chowder while you're here.
Yeah.
I will also say one more thing, not really against this book, but more just in general about it, which is that I don't think this book would have worked nearly as well if I hadn't read a billion other Discworld books before it.
Yeah, that's like, kind of the weird state of the Banger era, is that it is standing on the shoulders of slightly flawed giants.
I think that, like, some books work better than others. Like, I don't know, Carpe Jugulum has a ton of stuff in it that, like, you really want to have read the other witches books for, with all the characters.
Yeah, like,
but also it does work pretty well on its own. I don't know, this one, it's so tied up in the character of Ankh-Morpork.
Yes, I was
like
about to say,
Ankh-Morpork
is definitely a city that, it is a character that you have to read a lot of books to give even a quarter of a shit about.
Yeah, and like...
It's almost like this... Ankh-Morpork is a character in the book.
Holy shit!
That's literally what I just said.
I'm sorry.
But yeah, like, I feel like if I hadn't had all that time, if I hadn't had all the time reading the Watch books and all that, it wouldn't have hit nearly as hard, because just like, okay, well, you got a weird city. Okay, cool. On the other hand, I know I keep bringing up stuff, but I really loved this book. I really liked the implication that, like, there was something weird and supernatural going on, that William... and associated company have been marked for life by this, that, like,
okay,
the beginning with him getting hit in the head with the type was actually some sort of thing, and him just looking at the printing press and being like, you motherfucker, got me.
I have to point out, even at the time reading that, remember, the press that marked him had already been slagged by that point. He was looking at a completely different printing press and going, you motherfucker. As in, like, all y'all motherfuckers in general. The platonic idea of y'all motherfuckers.
Yeah. It's not a press, it's the press.
Yeah. It's the free
the
press.
The institution of printing.
Yeah.
But it gets him. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that he's like, fuck.
Y'all brain damaged me in just the right way.
We got hit by a print truck and isekai'd into journalism?
Damn it, Grace!
Which, admittedly, is exactly like what it feels like to be really, really hyper-fixated on a specific thing. Sometimes you just see that thing and you're like, you piece of shit, you got me for life, and you know it.
God, I'm sorry, Grace, I was literally pacing back around just because, you know, nervous energy, and I just fell over when you said that. So, like, congratulations.
Aw, flatters.
Yeah. Anyways, if any Discworld book has been improved by me ending up a trans lesbian with a bunch of very neurodivergent partners, it's this one, because I can project on it even more, and that's great.
Yeah.
Hell yes.
I loved this book.
Anyways, ranking, this is going to be a little difficult. Again, we're in the banger era, so I expect a lot of the titles here are going to be jockeying for the top, like, top five or whatever the hell. So we're just going to try to put things in. We're going to try to feel it out. We're going to go with vibes, and we're going to see where things lie. None of these should be regarded as like final positions of anything as to when we finish the series, but we'll see where we're at. So first off, would you say this is better or worse than our previous book that we had on the list, The Fifth Elephant, currently sitting at number 3?
Yes.
On the list. Let me put this into the chat so that y'all can look at it too real close.
Oh gosh!
I thought I already did.
Oh, you did. You did. Never mind.
You're so wise, dude.
I had to pull up the Discord window. I'm a fool.
I have in fact been doing that like before the last several books. Just as we gather, going, oh fuck! As soon as you mentioned rankings, I'm pulling it up.
You're so wise, dude.
You're so wise.
So, noted helpful move.
Mm-hmm. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Merry moves, Miss.
It's like way after by the time anyone else hears this, but I. And more importantly, all three of you gave me cool shit yesterday, so.
But yeah, well, I think it was better than The Fifth Element just because it's, again, I like The Fifth Element a lot, but the critiques that we leveled against it, I feel were pretty justified.
The
antagonism in that book was very, like, not that complex. Whereas in this book, there's a lot more wheels kind of spinning inside of it.
Yeah, this one's a lot more compelling. The story's a lot better put together. The jokes work more good.
It's much more philosophy versus philosophy rather than just philosophy versus a bad dude.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are you a bad enough dude to unelect the patrician?
No, apparently.
Yeah. Would we say that it's better or worse than Carpe Jugulum?
Like this better than Carpe Jugulum. I think it's tough, but like,
yeah, I'm really sorry, but I think that this book is gonna stay in the top three for a long time.
So like, here's the thing: I don't know if this book is better than Carpe Jugulum, because I can defend Carpe Jugulum really hard and it's really good. But I will say that me personally, I sure loved this book, and I would absolutely say I personally like it more.
Imposing
so,
our will onto reality is why we're doing this podcast.
Yeah, that's
for
being a
pretending
critic.
To be objective about it.
Yeah,
and
no,
once
definitely.
You write it down, it becomes the truth.
That's so true. Uh-huh.
More importantly, it doesn't have to be the truth forever. It just has to be the truth until tomorrow.
Until next episode. But yeah, like, I don't know. I like this book a fucking lot. I would put it above Carpe Jugulum.
I agree.
Are we gonna say that it's better or worse than Feet of Clay, though?
I don't think it's quite as good as Feet of Clay, just because
Feet of Clay is such a fucking banger, though. Yeah, that's the problem.
I would put it at number two. But it's a strong number two.
Once again,
number two works for me, yeah.
I think in this case, I definitely think Feet of Clay is a better book, like, in this, or no, that this book is better than Feet of Clay. The plot works better. There were parts of Feet of Clay that I didn't like, while there were, like, no parts of this one that I didn't like.
But it feels like the same situation as how Reaper Man got so high. Reaper Man is definitely a flawed book, but when it's on, it is pure fire. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's so good when it's on.
It is so hard to properly judge something that is consistently high versus something that peaks higher but values lower.
And like, while I did, but this one is just so consistent throughout the whole book.
I was just eating this thing whenever it was in front of me.
I'm gonna say that I've personally love Feet of Clay more because it's the book that made me cry the most so far, aside from maybe Reaper Man. But I can completely understand someone putting this above Feet of Clay. If that happened, I'd be like, makes sense.
I think our show's opinion, though, which is always the most correct one, is going to put it at number two.
Correct.
So, that's great. I'm really excited to see how this top five shifts over time. Next episode, we're going to be getting into Thief of Time, which I'm very excited about. That was always one of my faves from back in the day.
I'm really curious how that one's going to hold up.
Yeah, I don't know, because I remember, like, even though it was one of my favorites, I also remember it as being kind of uneven. So,
we're going to revisit this argument again, aren't we? Oh, boy.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be the argument for the entire series, you know?
We're going to have to compare two mountain ranges to one another, and that's going to be real interesting.
Yeah. Lastly, I'd like to say that I think you should all write more fan fiction. All of our listeners should read The Truth and then write fan fiction about it.
I agree. That would be cool. You should check it out. Please. Just because it's not part of one of the big series of Discworld doesn't mean it's not worth reading.
Mm-hmm. I don't like a lot of Discworld fan fiction just because I think a lot of it focuses too much on, like... I think that Discworld doesn't gel with a lot of the standard ways people write fan fiction a lot of the time.
I think people try to imitate Terry's writing style too much, and that's how things get fucked.
Yeah, either that, or they're just writing a normal fan fiction and just shoving Terry characters into it, and that also doesn't work. But when you can do both of them well, it works really well. And there can be some great stuff.
I'm still thinking about that weird tidbit that I think it was Zoe was talking about on your Doctor Who video game stream yesterday, June, about how, like, Douglas Adams was story editor for Doctor Who for a while because they kept getting people trying to write like Douglas Adams, but being bad at it. And it was basically his job to tell these people how to write less like him, but badly, which seems like a unique circle of hell for him to live in.
All these people are trying to be you.
They
and
love
it's like,
you. I mean, they want to be you.
It's
got to
be like
awful.
Nails on a chalkboard.
Oh, my God.
I mean, look, like, not to get too much of a downer here, like, that's something that Douglas Adams was struggling with hard by the end of his life. That's why the series was supposed to end with Earth blowing up in every timeline forever. Shut up, it's gone for good. He kind of came out of it right before... I mean, he never finished publishing when things actually got a little bit better. But... you know, the dude struggled with people trying to beat him for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
So, yes, you're right. That was a circle for hell in him, and it was one of the main things that led to his downfall.
Yes. Mm. Well, it's a good thing this isn't a Douglas Adams podcast. It's a Terry Pratchett podcast.
Yeah. Yep. Thank God.
And we all think you should definitely go write fan fiction, and you should write fan fiction about making these three losers kiss, and then you should send it to me so I can read it. Because
yes,
I think that's
please
great.
Do that. Every
if you really impress June, it'll filter up to the rest of us, and that'll be even better.
What we should really do is, like, we should do, like, a competition for fanfic writing for this show at some point.
Let's do a Discovers game jam.
Yes.
Yeah. Fuck, that's actually a good idea. Hang on. No, maybe
or
not.
Dame jam, for sure.
Let's not do that.
That sounds like a lot of work to organize. Let's workshop this idea and come back to it later.
To disorganize Mark 2?
Oh my God, you're right. Well, biggly bingly beep, it's time for the episode. Thanks for listening to Discovers. We appreciate your attention. You can find us online at... we're DiskPod on Blue Sky. We're DiskPod at queer.party on Mastodon. We're DiskPod on Co-host. We're also DiskPod on Twitter, if you still use Twitter. I'm Iris J. You can find me at irisj.net or at irisjcomics on the socials of medias. My thing that I want to promote this week that isn't Discworld is, so again, I guess if we recommended porn on this podcast, I could recommend this too. So my partner Nero and I have been rewatching through the Saw movies recently. I'd never seen them. The Saw movies are some of the most motion pictures I think ever made by humans. They're not as gory as I expected. They are written by, like, a middle schooler who thinks he's the edgiest person on the face of the earth,
The evil Make-A-Wish kid.
Yes, exactly. Literally, like, we finished watching Saw 3 the other night, and, like, that one was a little goopy gory, because there was, like, a weird brain surgery scene, and kind of squicked out by surgery. But John Kramer, Jigsaw of Saw, does have the line, death is like a birthday party unless you're already dead on the inside. And he says this without any irony whatsoever as he is dying of cancer in bed. All dialogue is like this in these movies. I'm not going to say that they're good movies. In fact, I would say that they're very bad movies. But if you want to watch some real bad 2000s horror, they're really interesting.
Oh.
Also, if you just want to watch people get into really wacky murder traps, if you just want to watch, like the OG Danganronpa shit. Yeah, like, yeah.
Super high school level.
Yeah, own, like, and it's really funny because like it starts with like they're also weirdly anti-cop movies, but I think by accident.
Yeah,
like
entirely
the second
by
movie's
accident.
All about the second movie's all about like a crooked violent cop who gets punished by Jigsaw because he bad cop, and like the movies are like, yo, Jigsaw is so fucked up, right? But like the whole time you're kind of like, I hope that Jigsaw wins. Like,
yeah.
Fuck this guy. This guy sucks.
Yeah, he deserves everything he's getting.
Yeah,
I mean,
fuck
in
him.
A later movie, then, he's going after the healthcare, the entire healthcare.
Yeah, it's
because they failed him so badly.
Apparently, the latest movie, Saw 10, is really good, and it's because it's the first Saw movie where the filmmakers realized, oh wait, people do want to root for Jigsaw. We should make the movie about Jigsaw instead of just having him be the antagonist of the Jigsaw films. So, if you want to check that out, it's still Halloween in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
Give it a try. They just dropped a bunch of the movies on Shudder. It's certainly, you can make an evening out of it if that's what you want to do with your life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can have saw those movies.
You can have saw those films. You can have saw the final chapter. You can have Spiral, the Book of Saw, those films.
I'm Juniper, as always. I've been doing a lot of, you can find me on social media. Mostly I'm on co-host nowadays, honestly, and you should be too. If you're not on co-host, get on co-host. It's a good website. I am at Juniper Theory on there. I've also been doing a lot of streaming recently at Juniper Theory on Twitch. Recently I've been streaming, doing a bunch of weird stuff. Most recently this week, as Iris mentioned, because Doctor Who came back today, although it'll probably have been back for a while by the time the episode comes out. I decided to, me, someone who does not like the show and has never watched it, I was going to stream every single Doctor Who video game. None of them are good. They all sucked. It was a terrible decision, but it was really fun. Anyways, the stuff I would like to recommend, so please come watch me stream, and the stuff I'd like to recommend that isn't me is, you know what? Me and my girlfriend have been watching, whenever we're just hanging out and like eating together or something, we've been watching the latest season of Taskmaster.
Yeah!
Season 16. And I've seen a few seasons just because it's great. It's great media to just throw on in the background while you're doing something else. And I have to say, season 16 is really special in that it is full of insane people in the best way. Just completely deranged season. There's Lucy Beaumont on the show, at least twice an episode will say something that just makes me go, what the fuck? What does that mean? What? I don't know, just completely baffled in the best way. So I recommend watching that. It's a fun time. And it's all free on YouTube. You can just find it there. Yeah.
I am still Belina. I'm still probably easier to find in the show notes because I'm this weird hermit most of the time these days. I'm almost certain that I recommended Void Stranger on a previous stream because that consumed all of my waking hours while I was obsessed with it. I am still kind of obsessed with it, but as a result, I ended up picking up Zero Ranger, so unfortunately, I'm going to continue to say just go play anything System Erasure ever does.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And I have been the internet's beloved Princess Grace. You can find my writing, programs, podcast posts, and anything else that's fit to plug at princess.software. Belina, where can we... No.
One of these goddamn days. One of these days, Grace.
Well, Pentesh, where can we find you?
No. I'm not even done making that one yet. I gotta get close to drawer first. And I got tied up on the podcast.
Well, be waiting, dear. Torn between a few things, but I think the last thing I thought of, and therefore the thing I'm going to go with, is the video game Rhythm Doctor, which I've been fucking obsessed with since I got it like a few weeks ago. It is the true heir to the Rhythm Heaven throne, I would say. It got right to the heart. It's emotionally resonant. The music's great. It's constantly thinking about one slip too late, but they're all good. Great video game, worth your time if you are like me, a rhythm game pervert, or want to get into them.
Yeah, I would say if you're the sort of person who enjoys, they're really good for the spectacle of rhythm game. If you're the sort of person who enjoys rhythm games a lot, but thinks, oh wow, yeah, I get to watch notes come down on a screen. Oh boy, I'm not as interested in that. This is the game for you. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I have friends who love those games, and I respect them, and I love watching them perform feats that I could never do. But I don't have that kind of brain. I have the brain that wants it all to look really pretty, and Rhythm Doctor's so good for that.
Yeah, and when I say it's the heir to the Rhythm Heaven Throne, I mean it's the kind of game where you can play by closing your eyes and feeling the rhythm. And that would actually serve you better sometimes. It's, less twitch reflexes, more hit it, more feeling the rhythm, and it feels really good when you do.
Hell yeah. I gotta give that a try. I'm back in the rhythm game sicko hole after a Hi-Fi Rush, basically.
Yeah.
The end of the year. I played a lot of video games this year. None were better than Hi-Fi Rush, in my opinion.
Hi-Fi Rush whipped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, thank you all for joining us. Join us next time for Thief of Time. Until then, it truly was. We could do the joke, it truly was the truth, but then that doesn't work because.
Truly, they were the truth.
What's
at least
up?
For a little while.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. For now. See you next issue, folks.
Follow your discs.
Mm-hmm.
So long.
Wow.
Thanks for all the discs.